Well, we are going to be in the book of Exodus, Exodus chapter 11, and we are making our way through a verse-by-verse study of the book of Exodus. So if you're visiting with us today, we welcome you, and we're so glad that you are here with us. You join us right at the end of what's commonly referred to as the plague events, the 10 plagues, and we've been categorizing those as 12 miraculous signs that the Lord did. We see the front end, we see a miraculous sign that was done, and then at the end, we see the drowning of the Egyptian army as a miraculous sign as well. So we've packaged those all together, and we're coming up to the end. This is a chapter where, strictly speaking, nothing actually happens. There's just a warning, but the warning is action-packed for Pharaoh. And it's a warning that covers some ground that Moses has been over before and also lets Pharaoh know of a few things that are about to happen if he does not relent and let the Israelites go. As most of you know, I did youth ministry for years and years before coming as the lead pastor here, and actually still working with our students still today. And I love doing youth ministry and speaking to students. And years ago, I was looking for something that would maybe shake the kids up a little bit and cause them to think. I said, I want to do a study that may cause our students to think about God in a little bit different sort of way, open their eyes to some things. And a lot of times when we talk about God, we rightly emphasize things like God is love, and we find joy in the Lord, and we need to be nice to each other and get along and, you know, give some money, be good stewards. And just like Mama said, if you don't have anything nice to say, then what? Don't say anything at all. And we kind of sum up Christianity in that. Just be nice to each other and don't be a jerk and love some people. And, well, then you'll just have it. That's kind of it. And those are all true as far as they go. Those statements are all absolutely true as far as they go. But it's really only part of the story. We also learn that God is a God of justice. And we learn that God will actually judge. And that is not a popular message in our culture today, folks, that God will actually judge. And people say, well, why got to talk about this God of judgment? Can't we just talk about, you know, butterflies and nice things? Like, well, here's the problem. It's in the Bible, one. And two, I actually think you're going to meet this God. So I want to prepare you as well as I can to meet him, because he's revealed himself in his word. So with my students, wanting to shake them up a little bit, I said, I know what we'll do. And I had heard this idea from somebody else. I titled the study, The Forgotten God. And we went through the Old Testament, starting in the Old Testament, and we looked at all the people God killed in the Bible. Now that's an exciting study, people. The people God killed. And when I started looking at this, it was pretty shocking to me. Because there was no new story that I had never heard of, but when you start to line up these stories and your jaw drops to see this God that we have domesticated down into something that belongs on a Hallmark card. Yes, God is a God of love, but if you don't understand something of the seriousness of sin and the judgment of the Lord, that statement is a little bit hollow and you don't actually understand it. You know, we don't make it far in the Bible before the Lord's wiping out the population. You ever thought about that? Genesis 6, the flood. You hadn't made it real far. You know, you're in the first few pages still. And the Lord is wiping out the population because of their sin. You don't go much farther until he's taking out entire cities, Sodom and Gomorrah, because of their wickedness, Genesis 19. You start to look ahead and he strikes down the priest, Nadab and Abihu, Aaron's sons, who offer strange fire before the Lord, Leviticus 10. And he says, don't weep for them. They deserved it. And it's a solemn time. Then you read in Numbers about the rebellion of Korah, where God opens up the ground and swallows people. And then he incinerates some on the spot for taking on a priestly role that they were not supposed to have. And then he sends a plague, a pestilence, for those who complain. After reading and thinking a little bit about that, I started to think it's actually a little bit shocking that any of us live, rather than that God actually takes people out. We don't like death. We don't like thinking about death. We don't like talking about death. And I completely understand that. whenever I have opportunity to do a memorial service or a funeral, I always mention that death hurts because it was not originally a part of the plan. It was introduced because of sin. It's one of the horrible consequences of sin. A lot of times we love verses like 1 Corinthians 15, where it says, when the perishable puts on the imperishable and the mortal puts on the immortality, then shall come to pass the saying that is written, death is swallowed up in victory. Oh, death, where is your victory? Oh, death, where is your sting? And we tend to lock in on those last two phrases. Death, where is your victory? Death, where is your sting? What's the problem with that? We missed the bold letters. Those were bolded by me. That was not original. Just want to make sure you got that. When means it hasn't happened yet. Death still stings now. Pain still hurts now. Death, it's unnatural. It hurts. It's painful. It makes us very uncomfortable to talk about it, to think about it. And so when we parachute down into a text like we have this morning, and we have the Lord himself saying, I'm going to spread myself out amongst the Egyptians, and I'm going to take out the firstborn in all of the houses. Oh, and by the way, I'm going to take out the firstborn of the cattle too, just so you can know that I am the Lord. It takes our breath away. We think, Lord, what are you doing? What is this? We live in a broken world. Death is real. And it hurts. It's painful. But we need to wrestle with this. So a little bit of context. The Egyptians and death. Now remember the Egyptians. These are the people that built these things. The pyramids, right? Never been to the pyramids myself, but Pexels.com is a wonderful invention. If you ever need a picture of something, you can find it right there. You know what these are? They were tombs, right? And scholars are divided over exactly what is going on inside of these tombs and what exactly were they meant for, what was happening. But the Egyptians, we know, at the bottom baseline of the whole thing, we know that they were very concerned with the afterlife. And they were very concerned with this idea of death. These pyramids were standing during Israel's time in Egypt. We probably never put them in a historical context and think. The Israelites probably saw these things, many of them, depending on what region exactly they were in. They were very, very concerned with the afterlife. Some scholars even believe that some of the Egyptian priests of the pantheon, the mini gods of the gods of Egypt, they believed these were sort of a resurrection machine type of thing, that it was going to help them and their pharaohs, their leaders. Only important people ended up in these, but it was going to help them somehow get into the afterlife. So the Egyptians were very concerned about death, and they were very concerned about what happens next. They were also very concerned about lines of succession, the next one in line. And then we come to our story. Moses tells them, there's going to be this horrible thing happens. God is the God of life and death, and he's going to take out the firstborn. Now, this is such a blow to Egyptian thought of the day. The firstborn was a significant person in each family. So let's jump into the Exodus event, and I want to read chapter 11. We'll look at these 10 verses today, Exodus 11, and we'll break it down in very simple, big points this morning for you. Chapter 11. Actually, I want to back up two verses and start reading from there, because this is really a continuation of this account. So 10:28 says, then Pharaoh said to him, get away from me. Take care never to see my face again, for on the day that you see my face, you shall die. Moses said, as you say, I will not see your face again. The Lord said to Moses, yet one plague more I will bring upon Pharaoh and upon Egypt. Afterward, he will let you go from here. When he lets you go, he will drive you away completely. Speak now in the hearing of the people, that they ask, every man of his neighbor and every woman of her neighbor, for silver and gold jewelry. And the Lord gave the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. Moreover, the man Moses was very great in the land of Egypt and in the sight of Pharaoh's servants and in the sight of the people. So Moses said, "Thus says the Lord, about midnight I will go out from the midst of Egypt, and every firstborn in the land of Egypt shall die, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sits on the throne, even to the firstborn of the slave girl who is behind the handmill, and the firstborn of all cattle. There shall be a great cry throughout all the land of Egypt, such as there has never been, nor ever will be again. But not a dog shall growl against any of the people of Israel, either man or beast, that you may know that the Lord makes a distinction between Egypt and Israel. And all these, your servants, shall come down to me and bow down to me, saying, 'Get out, you and all the people who follow you.' And after that, I will go out." And he went out from Pharaoh in hot anger. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Pharaoh will not listen to you, that my wonders may be multiplied in the land of Egypt." Moses and Aaron did all these wonders before Pharaoh, and the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he did not let the people of Israel go out of his land. Two big sections that we'll see in this. The first is this idea of providence. The providence of God in verses 1 through 3. The providence of God. At the end of chapter 10, we see that Pharaoh lays down the gauntlet and says, "Moses, if I see you again, I'm going to kill you." Moses turns it around and he says, "You're right, you're not going to see me again." And they have this confrontation. And so what's going on here in chapter 11? We don't know exactly who Moses is talking to until we get down to verse 8, where we see that he's still talking to Pharaoh. So what we have is basically they get into this heated conversation. "I'm not going to see you again." "Yeah, you're right, you're not going to see me again." He turns to go, and this is sort of an, "Oh, by the way, I have one more thing to tell you." And so that's where we pick up the story. One more thing. There's going to be one more plague that's going to come. He turns to Pharaoh, delivers this final message. What we see is God's providence, God's control over circumstances, over wealth, and then even over public opinion. These will resonate with us because they cut at the heart of who we are. We care about these three things, right? Right? Y'all don't look at me like that. I know. Yeah. I'm not the only one. Circumstances, wealth, and public opinion. I'm going to venture a guess this morning and say, if you had the opportunity to change something about your circumstances, either because of your own decisions that you've made, or maybe because of decisions other people have made, you would probably change something about your circumstance in life, right? You would probably change something. It can be hard to see how events of life fit into God's sovereign plan. And in reality, we won't know all the pieces and how they fit together. But just because you can't see the purpose doesn't mean there's not one. I think sometimes we're looking at the back of a cross stitch, right? Looks like chaos. But you turn it over and there's a beautiful picture. The Lord's doing something. He's up to something, but all we're seeing is threads going in seemingly random directions. What we learn in chapter 11 is that the Lord has been orchestrating this whole deal the whole time so that it turned out just like this. He said there's going to be one more thing, and after this, he's going to drive you away completely. All of it was lined up to do this. I love what one commentator wrote on this point. He says, "Moses was writing this story not merely to help his fellow Israelites trust Yahweh, the Lord, as things happen to them, but to help them learn to trust that Yahweh is the one who makes things happen in the first place as part of the great redemptive plan for his people. It's not just trust the Lord while things are going on. It's trust the Lord because he's making things go on. It's thank the Lord for the circumstances that I'm in because he's got a plan and a promise." Now, I can't promise you that everything you're going through, every experience that you have, you're going to be able to see with the type of clarity that these Israelites were able to see. But we do know there's a pretty good verse about this in the New Testament, right? You may have ever heard of this one, Romans 8:28. we know that for those who love God, all things work together for good for those who are called according to his purpose. The Lord is at work, controlling circumstances. All of this that happened in the life of Israel, which was a lot, all of it led to this point of this final plague where God is going to send out the people of Israel. Next, we see that God also controls wealth. Now, this is an interesting little verse here in verse 2. Speak now in the hearing of the people, that they ask every man of his neighbor and every woman of her neighbor for silver and gold jewelry. Now, what in the world is going on here? There's a lot of different theories on what exactly could be going on here. What is this? Some people think, well, it's Israel's wages. They're being collected. They had served as slaves for 400 years. They're getting paid back for their time that they worked. Possibility. Could be the price of redemption to release a slave. It costs money to buy their freedom, so it's a sort of a price of redemption, a military tribute. Could be the conquering military that's about to conquer them. Regardless, whatever we say about this, it's a sign of divine favor, and it's a free will offering by the Egyptians. And what you see is a growing chasm between Pharaoh and his people. His people are starting to say, I think they're going to win. I'm going to go to their team. Pharaoh is hardening his heart and going the other direction. Interestingly, too, we see that this is a fulfillment of prophecy. We see that the Lord spoke many, many years ago, 400 years earlier, to Abraham, but I will bring judgment on the nation that they serve, and afterward they shall come out with great possessions. So we see it's a fulfillment. We knew that it was going to go this way. Now there's all kinds of interesting things to point out with this particular verse. This widening division between Pharaoh and his people. Now, picture the scene. Pharaoh's approval ratings, all-time lows at this point. His servants are starting to doubt him. We see that some of the people in chapter 12, it says there's a mixed multitude that leave. Some of the Egyptians are like, they've got Yahweh on their side, the one that's killing people and sending bugs and turning our water into blood. I'm going with them. And so the Bible records that there's a mixed multitude, partly Egyptians, that leave. They actually take part in the Exodus. Some of the Egyptians listened to the warning about the hail, and they got inside, got undercover, and weren't affected. The Egyptian people, through this tribute that they give to the Israelites, they're able to participate in some fashion in God's redemptive plan. Now, this might be the first crowdfunded Kickstarter campaign in history. All right? Think about it. New nation getting off the ground. Slave people, hey, can I have some gold and jewelry and silver? We're going to need some resources as we get this thing off the ground. Listen, y'all, you want to be in on the grassroots of this deal. We're going to a land flowing with milk and honey. It's going to be awesome. We have the God of the universe on our side. We're going to institute a humane 6-day work week. We're going to take a day off during the week. Sounds pretty cool. Don't you want to give? Don't you want to be a part of this? This nation's going to be a light to the nations. So would you like to buy into our gold package or our silver package? And the people did it. They did it. They actually did it. It's hard to know the mood of the people. And it's likely very mixed. But I'm sure some of the Israelites, or some of the Egyptians, they saw Israel as a nuisance and said, what do I have to write a check for to get you to leave? They probably had that. There were others who said, we're going to all die. And whatever it takes for you to go. Now, we need to be careful with this. I don't want to twist this into some weird health and wealth sort of message. So the application of this particular text is not go door to door in your neighborhood and ask them for their money and treasures this afternoon. You can try it. There may be some charges brought against you that may not work out so well for you. Ask your neighbors for fine jewelry. Like, hey neighbor, can I have some jewelry? That's probably not going to go over all that well. What's the point? The point is that the Lord is providing for his people. He's going to provide them with land. He's going to provide them with cities they did not build. And he's going to provide them, he resources them to leave Egypt. They went in, why? Because of a famine. They had nothing. They were barely surviving. They're walking out with a couple million people, and they are rich, and they're going out to possess the land that God gave them. Things are beginning to look up for the Israelites. All of a sudden, didn't seem likely there for a little while. But this is what the Lord's doing. He controls wealth. We also see that the Lord controls public opinion. He controls public opinion. I've mentioned this already, but it's worth mentioning here. The kingdom is beginning to slip away from Pharaoh. Look at verse 3. The Lord gave the people favor in the sight of the Egyptians. Moreover, the man Moses was very great in the land of Egypt, in the sight of Pharaoh's servants, and in the sight of the people. So, what's happened? How unlikely. How unlikely that Moses is now lifted up and the people think he's great. How unlikely is that? Oh, the fugitive that's wanted for murderer? The subpar public speaker that didn't think he could handle this assignment? He was sort of the quasi half-retired shepherd that was hanging out in Midian for 40 years, right? The Bible says he was content to dwell in Midian. He bought an equivalent of a Midianite minivan, and he's just hanging out, having kids, and doing his thing. And the Lord comes to him and says, you're going to lead the people. And here he is, some months later, standing, and the people of Egypt and the people of Israel are looking at him as their leader. And they're bowing down to him. And they're giving his people their prized possessions. And Pharaoh, the lunatic, autocratic, madman ruler, is watching his kingdom slip away from him. All by the Lord's design. So these people, they seem to have no hope. They seem to have nothing going for them at all. The roles have completely reversed. And they're going to... the Lord will change things dramatically for them. So we see the providence of God, providence in circumstances, providence in their wealth that they'll leave Egypt with, and then providence also in public opinion. He changed things for them. Next, in verses 4 through 10, we see the sovereignty of God. Really, every page in Exodus is in some sense a lesson on the sovereignty of God. You almost can't read Exodus without thinking at some level about God's control over the events and elements that are going on. And that's really part of the point of the book of Exodus, of course. Specifically, we see some things here that God is sovereign over life, dogs, Egypt, nature, and hearts. Now, you may be trying to find a tie-in with dogs, right? We'll get there. We'll get there. Be patient. Life, dogs, Egypt, nature, and hearts. Let's look at this. Verse 4. So Moses says, thus says the Lord, about midnight, I will go into the midst of Egypt. Every firstborn in the land of Egypt shall die, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sits on the throne, even to the firstborn of slave girl who is behind the handmill, and all the firstborn of the cattle. There's going to be a great cry throughout the city. God is sovereign over life. God promised that this would happen back in Exodus 4. When he's calling out Moses, he says, you're going to say to Pharaoh, thus says the Lord, Israel is my firstborn son, and I say to you, let my son go that he may serve me. If you refuse to let him go, behold, I will kill your firstborn son. So Israel, the nation, is God's firstborn. If you hold on to my firstborn, I'm going to take your firstborn. So Pharaoh has been warned over and over again. Many months ago, he was warned. Now it's time for this to come to pass. As I mentioned earlier, this passage is a little bit disturbing to us because we just don't like death, understandably so. We especially don't like God taking personal responsibility for death. We don't like death en masse, and we don't like the death of little ones in particular. So this passage really offends our sensibilities on so many levels. But here it is. Here it is, and we need to deal with it. Right here in this passage. Now, I'll be the first one to say that you've probably got questions that I am not going to adequately address about this passage. I don't have every answer, but I do want to give you a few thoughts that have been some comfort to me and help as I think through this. Let's just point out something really obvious, and I hope that this alone will bring a little bit of comfort for you as you think through this. Think about this. God did not make anything happen that wasn't already going to happen. All right? He didn't make anything happen that wasn't already going to happen. It's not as though God took immortal beings, children of Egyptians, and suddenly made them mortal. All right? So they weren't going to die, now they are going to die. He didn't do that. He didn't make anything happen that wasn't already going to happen. He took human beings that were necessarily going to die, and he fixed their day of death before we would have liked and at the same time, which we really don't like. People die all the time. People die every day. We lose our minds when people die at once. We don't like that, understandably so. But that's what the Lord did. Death is never convenient. It's never at the right time. When's the right time? It's never the right time. Death is hard and it hurts. We need to also remember this. Life is a gift from God. All right? Life is not a given. It's a gift from God. The Bible uses an interesting word. It's the Hebrew word ruach. It can be translated spirit, as in the Holy Spirit. It can also be translated spirit with a small s, as in the life inside of us. And God gives us his ruach, his spirit. And that's what makes us alive. Living things have God's spirit, his ruach. And God can choose to take his life back from any living thing at any point, and he owes them no explanation for why he chooses to do that. God is sovereign over life. It's not as though God wrongfully took something that they deserved. God is sovereign over that process. So the major question really is, not so much how is it that God took life, but really how is it that any of us are alive, that we have God's spirit, life, inside of us. Over the years, I've found great comfort in Hebrews 9:27. It says, "And just as it is appointed for man once to die, after that comes judgment." It's appointed, all will die, and after that is judgment. It's appointed to die. All die, and all die by appointment. You can't leave planet Earth, whatever human means or processes we see taking place, you actually can't leave until God punches your ticket and says, okay, you can go now. It's by appointment, and you can't accelerate that. God is over that. We all die, and it's by appointment. This text tells us this plague strikes without discrimination, from the wealthiest to the poorest, the highest social class, the Pharaoh, down to the maidservant, the slave girl at the handmill, strikes without discrimination. Death is the great equalizer, isn't it? So God is sovereign over life. On a lighter note, God is sovereign also over dogs. All right? How's that transition for you? It's right here in the text. I didn't make it up. I would not choose to insert dogs at this point, but it's right here. So let's deal with it. Verse 7. "But now a dog, but not a dog, shall growl against any of the people of Israel, either man or beast, that you may know that the Lord makes a distinction between Egypt and Israel." What in the world is going on here? Not a dog will growl. Why is this inserted right here? I think it's further lesson about the sovereignty of God over even things like animals. Now, we need to talk a little bit about dogs in this culture and context. When you're thinking dog, you're probably thinking Fluffy that lives in your house, or you're thinking your golden retriever or your lab or whatever nice, I'm sure, wonderfully well-behaved, never-bark-in-the-middle-of-the-night dog you have. God bless you, dog owners. You're probably thinking that. You need to take that image and put it out of your mind and think mangy mutts running around that people think of more as rats, like we would think of rats, than we think of dogs. That's more what's being talked about here. They didn't have Fluffy in the, you know, doggy daycare center in Egypt at the time. It was just not that way. These were mangy mutts that were considered a total nuisance. Now, there are nights in my neighborhood where I have wished for the superpower of making a dog stop barking. I don't know if any of you have ever had that experience. God actually has it. He actually caused the dogs not to growl at the people as they were exiting. It's just amazing, isn't it? It's amazing. But I think there's something else going on here too. I've told you before, and we've looked in Exodus 12, we'll see it again, that this was a judgment not just against the Egyptians, it was also a judgment against their gods. All right? And we've interacted with that idea many times as we've looked at these different plagues, these things that the Lord did. There were two gods that stood over the realm of the dead, Osiris and Anubis. Now, Anubis was thought to be sort of the assistant god over the embalming process in Egyptian thought. Anubis was depicted as having a human body, and guess what kind of head? A dog's head. Now, isn't that interesting? Would it look something like this in ancient Egyptian art? Now, it's a little bit debatable, but as the kids say, sure looks like he's throwing some shade here, right? Sure looks like he's going after this false god of the dead. He says, he's not in charge of death. I am. You can't leave planet Earth without me. Not even the dogs are going to be able to do anything about Israel leaving. They won't even growl. I think that's what's going on. Remember, God didn't come to win. He came to dominate. He came to show that he is the sovereign one over all things. Now, some of you may be thinking, well, that's great, but what in the world does that have to do with me? I have never once had thoughts about dogs and false gods and the pantheon of Egyptian gods, that sort of thing. I think Kevin DeYoung has a helpful quote that I want to read for you. He says, though in America we may not bow down to gods and have statues that we call Osiris or Anubis, is it not the case that so many of us worship at the feet of those same gods? We have medicine that will help us live forever. We have insurance so that everything can be taken care of for us. We're able to eat the right foods and exercise in the right way so that we won't get sick and we can live forever, right? What are we trying to do? Just like the ancient people, we're trying to avoid this god of death as we perceive him. Well, ancient people were so superstitious. Oh, really? What about us doing everything in our power to live? Now, of course, DeYoung is not anti-doing everything in your power to live. He's asking the question, do we have the seeds of this in our own hearts, where we are tempted to think that someone else or something else controls our lives more than the Lord? He's the God of life. He's the God over death, over the whole process. So God is sovereign. He's sovereign over life. He's sovereign over dogs. He's sovereign over Egypt. He's sovereign over Egypt. Look at this. Verse 8. And all these your servants shall come down to me and bow down to me, saying, get out, you and all the people who follow you. And after that, I'll go out. Moses completely turns Pharaoh's court on himself. He says, your servants are going to come, and they're going to bow to me. That's a good way to get your head chopped off in this culture. Hey, I'm taking over your whole court. They're going to bow to me. You can't say that. But he does. The people are going to beg the Israelites to leave. Pharaoh is being completely humiliated because of his obstinance against the Lord. He's sovereign also over nature. Look at verse 9. Then the Lord said to Moses, Pharaoh will not listen to you, that my wonders may be multiplied in the land of Egypt. Some have tried to explain away the miraculous events that take place in purely naturalistic terms. Well, you know, it was just a flood and there was a flower bloom which caused the Nile River to turn a reddish color that sort of kind of looked like blood, and then it caused some animals to die so that the bugs came to those animals, and we can really create all kinds of scenarios to say, look, these are all natural, until we get to the last one. How do you explain this other than the hand of the Lord? The Lord chooses many natural elements, transforming water, frogs, gnats, mosquitoes, hail, locust, but we stop short if we don't also recognize that the Lord did this so that he could demonstrate his power. He's sovereign over nature, completely sovereign over nature. Lastly, we see that he's sovereign over hearts. Now, just in case you missed it, the previous 21 times in the narrative that we have a mention of Pharaoh's heart, that's a major feature in this whole equation. Verse 10, Moses and Aaron did all these wonders before Pharaoh, and the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, and he did not let the people of Israel go. Now, we've covered this territory before, so I won't reinvent the wheel. I did a whole sermon on Pharaoh's heart and sovereignty and responsibility. You can find that online, I'm sure, if you're interested to learn a little bit more about that. We make a mistake to pit those against each other as if God is not sovereign or man is not responsible. They work together. I love Charles Spurgeon's quote on this. He was asked one time, how do you reconcile divine sovereignty and human responsibility? How do you reconcile the fact that God is completely free and man is completely free? How can you put those together? And Spurgeon said, I never have to reconcile friends. Divine sovereignty and human responsibility have never had a falling out with each other. I do not need to reconcile what God has joined together. He said, where these truths meet, I do not know, nor do I want to know. They do not puzzle me, since I have given up in my mind to believing them both. With apologies to Mr. Spurgeon, they do puzzle me a little bit still, all right? I'm still wrestling through that, but I have to say, they both exist. God is sovereign. Man is responsible. Pharaoh's obstinance, and he's seen as responsible for his obstinance over and over and over again. He has brought this judgment on himself for this purpose. You know, we won't take too long this morning to explore this, but I do at least want to mention it as we're rounding out our discussion of these miraculous events. We'll move into the Passover next, and then we'll see the Exodus proper just after that, where the Israelites actually leave. Most all of these plagues, these events that happen, are recorded again for us in the future, in Revelation. You have things like gnats and locusts and strange things happening with water. You have livestock dying. You have mention of frogs and other bugs. In the book of Revelation, these are repeated again. What's the point? Just like God defeated Egypt, so he will defeat those in the final rebellion. And it looks very similar. So how do we avoid that? How do we avoid these plagues? It's by being in union with the true Son, Jesus Christ. That's how. That's how we do it. You know, I told you earlier about the study I did with my students where we looked at these places where God killed people. And we had all kinds of interesting conversation about that, especially when you get to places like Elisha calling down bears out of the woods to eat people. There's all kinds of interesting stories. So after we looked at the nature and the character of God that we see in so many of these passages, we went and said, what's the answer? What are we going to do? We concluded this series with Isaiah 53. Can't we stop the killing? Yes, we can. The killing is stopped as the Son was crushed on our behalf. God's not going to take you out. He took out Jesus. And as we're in union with him, he bears the weight, the responsibility of our sin is put on him. Isaiah 53:10. Yet it was the will of the Lord to crush him. He has put him to grief when his soul makes an offering for guilt. He shall see his offspring. he shall prolong his days. The Lord, the will of the Lord shall prosper in his hand. Jesus bore God's wrath on our behalf. We now find our hope, our rest, our protection as we are in union with Jesus Christ. Let me pray for us. God, we're grateful for the work of Christ. We recognize this morning that we're no different than the Egyptians. We're no different. We fabricate. We look for other things, other gods to trust in. As one author said, our hearts are factories of idols. We continually reproduce more and more things to distract us from the true and living God. Lord, our idols may look very different than the ones here in Egypt, but they're idols still. They're idols all the same. So, Lord, root these things out of our hearts. Show us our desperate need for Christ. We thank you that it was your will to crush him so that we can live. What a joy to rejoice in the gospel this morning.